Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the Red Rover edition. I'm Shane Harris of the Daily Beast, here with my friends Ben Wittes. Hello, Ben.
Hey.
Nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
Yeah. And Tamara Kaufman Wittes, usually with us here, has escaped D.C. in advance of a potentially historic snowstorm. We're calling this potentially historic,
yes,
is the new phrase being attached to this. She's not in a snowy place, but
no,
where's your wife?
Well, she is. I just got a text from her that she was going to what I think is the coolest named coffee shop in the world. It is in the Golan Heights overlooking the Syrian border with Israel, and it is called Coffee Anon. And so this is a triple pun, actually, because Anon in Hebrew means cloud. And so this is the coffee shop in the clouds, but it's also where all the UN peacekeepers go for coffee. So it's named Coffee Anon after Kofi Annan, but also coffee in the clouds.
I feel like, okay, when I was in the Golan Heights about a year and a half ago, we went to this really cool coffee shop that had really good chocolate. And I don't remember if that was it.
It probably
might have
was.
Been. There's not a ton of coffee.
Does it kind
shops.
Of seem like it kind of like a rest stop? Like it has a big,
yes,
parking lot, and it's like nice.
That's
and has
it.
Chocolate inside.
That's it.
Well, it doesn't have a big parking, but it is overlooking,
right,
a valley as you and the city, the Syrian city of Kunetra.
There can't be a lot of gourmet coffee shops in the Golan Heights, right?
It's a good coffee shop, and it's pretty isolated.
Oh, wait,
on the border. And anyway, Tammy sends her greetings to Rational Security viewer listeners from Coffee Anon.
Is this where it is? Is that it? I don't think I went there.
I can't see it.
I don't know. This looks a little more like a lodge. Oh, wait, maybe I did go here. I don't know. You know what? Maybe I did. It was a long time ago. I was
anyway,
on drugs. No, it's not.
That's
true.
Why Tammy's not here.
Tammy's not here, but our good friend Susan Hennessy is here. Hello,
I am,
Susan.
Indeed. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Managing editor of Lawfare has been a special guest many, many a time. And you have been to this coffee shop. I'm looking at pictures of it now from the inside. I don't think I went to this one. I feel like I was cheated.
Next week on Rational Security.
You went to Coffee Utah.
Shane Ben to this coffee shop. Yes or no?
I'm pretty sure I wasn't here.
It's Coffee a lovely Boutros Ghali. It's the other Secretary's General.
I went to this off-brand UN Secretary General coffee shop. I was cheated. It was a little bit of an off-brand trip too, but I'm not going to get into that right now. But you know, it was fun. We had to see some things. This week on the show, besides talking about coffee and bracing for blizzards, it's been a busy week. Four Americans are freed in a prisoner swap with Iran.
Red Rover, send our hostages over.
Send our sanctions violators right over.
Yeah, and send our people you haven't even indicted yet.
That's true.
Right over, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, we let people who were just like in a...
I think some of them elected to stay, actually.
Did they? Who the hell would go back to Iran?
Stick in the
eye, if you were... Well, I guess if you were... These people weren't necessarily like enemies of the state, but I think many of them had left a long time ago. I might opt to just kind of take my chances with the U.S. justice.
It's just, thanks, mullahs, for getting me a pardon or a non-pros agreement. But I'm staying in Cleveland.
But I'm staying. They did want them back, clearly. Well, maybe they didn't want them back. They wanted somebody back. We're going to talk about that. Twitter is facing a lawsuit over jihadist messages posted on the site. And Secretary of Defense Ash Carter is cracking down on everybody. It's discipline week at the Pentagon. Let's start with the four American prisoners. I'll start with that as my wordplay. I was playing those words all weekend. We got word that four Americans who had been held in Iran, probably most well-known among them, Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter, but also others, including a man named Amir Hekmati, who was held the longest of Americans in Iran, were freed on Saturday. This was something that we've learned had been in the works for quite some time. A separate track had developed kind of an outgrowth of the nuclear negotiations. And it became clear, administration officials said, that there was going to be some ability to get these prisoners out, but that it needed to be something separately conducted separately from the nuclear negotiations, which I have to admit I found a little hard to believe. It was the same people involved in those discussions as in the nuclear negotiations, or at least a certain number of them. They kind of happened in a parallel track to the negotiations. Oh, and by the way, this prisoner swap just happened to coincide with the day of the implementation of the Iranian nuclear deal, the so-called implementation day, which, you know, we've been anticipating for 6 months. It's not like it snuck up on you like a snowstorm. I think it's, you know, it's, the families are very happy. I think probably it's a small price to pay. That's my personal opinion for trading these seven people, some of whom we hadn't even prosecuted yet. Some of whom, I think all of whom, were charged or pled guilty to offenses that would no longer be illegal because the sanctions are being lifted. I'd be curious to get your take on that, you guys. But to me, just saying that this was somehow totally separate and they just happened to coincide with each other with the nuclear deal just sort of strains credulity, I think.
Look, I mean, there's a little bit of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Sure.
But I feel like it's kind of a nice, heartwarming, good news story, you know, to capture the headlines on Implementation Day. Mm-hmm.
And kind of overshadowed Implementation Day, too.
Funny how that worked
out rather nicely for
the administration.
Yeah.
Look, I have no doubt that the wink, wink, nudge, nudge occurred during the negotiations
sure.
as well, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that these were actively put on the table at the same time. Certainly everybody understands that there's parallel negotiations going on. I do think that this sort of underscores what the administration has long been saying, which was highlighting the need for the secrecy of the negotiations and not mm-hmm. releasing the plans and all of sort of the attendant details or side negotiations until everything was finalized.
You mean the nuclear plan?
Right.
Yeah.
And so it just sort of it underscores the kind of the sensitivities at play, the various moving pieces, and really the ability for any one person to kind of screw things up.
Right. Because it had this leaked out early. I mean, the administration seemed, and I think this is I think plausible, that had the word of this leaked out too early that this was going on, it could scuttle the deal.
But I think it's perfectly possible for the deal for them to be separate tracks, not formally connected, and yet intricately connected at the same time. And here's how you do it. If you're Iran, you say, you don't say to the Americans this, but you say internally, we're not letting these people go because the Americans care about it, care about them until the moment that we know for sure that sanctions are really being lifted. And so you have as you move toward implementation day, an increasingly viable separate track negotiation that's becoming more viable because the Iranians are gaining confidence that they're actually getting the ransom that these hostages are in fact being held for. And then, so once you're actually near implementation day, it's not a particularly difficult thing to say, okay, we're ready now to do a Red Rover, you know, you guys send us our sanctions violators and we'll send you your journalists. And so I think it's actually perfectly consistent for them to be totally intricately interconnected and in fact dependent on one another, but at a formal negotiations level, separate tracks that are essentially unrelated. Can I just say that the desire on the part of a lot of Republicans to make this a bad thing is really weird? Prisoner exchanges, several of the Republican presidential candidates and senior senators were on Sunday talk shows this weekend complaining about this deal. And saying that, you know, we're really happy these people are back with their families, but this shows the weakness of the administration. And I always found that bewildering because, you know, trading hostages and prisoners including with regimes you really don't like, and trading people you regard as innocent for people who you regard as guilty is as old as the day is long.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it over and over and over again with the Soviets and with other Eastern Bloc regimes. We trade people that are of value to the other side to people who are of value to
us. It's Bridge of Spies.
As dramatized by a newly nominated Bridge of Spies.
Right, although...
Different situation.
Gary Francis Powers was not...
Was actually a spy.
Was actually, flying a plane in violation of their sovereignty. He wasn't an innocent journalist. Right. But we give up people of value who are actually guilty of things under our law for people who we regard as innocent who are... you know, apparently guilty under somebody else's law of something that we don't think they should have been prosecuted for all the time. And I'm a little bit mystified by what Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and even responsible Republicans like Marco Rubio think they're complaining about in this context.
But I mean, I don't think that's mystifying at all. That's just crass, brazen politics, right? If Obama did it, it's bad. And I'm not like a reflexive defender of the president, but I mean, I think this underscores the extent to which, you know, they can't be happy with anything that even results in the freedom for Americans who were, in our view, quite unjustly detained and prosecuted. Well, and they're just going to attack him for it. And it's tied to the Iran nuclear deal, too, right? It's another chance to bash the nuclear deal.
Right. And speaking of violations of sovereignty, for 10 U.S. sailors to float on into Iranian territorial waters mere hours before this exchange was set, I think that it's part of the Republican sort of, it's all part of the same narrative of no matter what the outcome, it's a reflection of the fact that the administration did something wrong.
I mean, I think we all probably generally agree that as deals go, this seems like a decent one, right? It's not like we gave up and we didn't give up any terrorists. There is an Iranian currently serving time in U.S. prison for conspiracy with Qasem Soleimani to kill the Saudi ambassador.
Right, we didn't give,
We didn't give him up. I mean, these are sanctions violators. And in some of their cases that I've looked into, you know, part of their defense was actually that the sanctions regime was so complicated they didn't know that they were actually violating it. And that they had actually, in some cases, retained attorneys to see if it was okay to sell some of the products that they were. Point being is these people would have mounted, you know,
a defense.
Right,
it's a white-collar crime.
Yeah, exactly. These are not, you know, and this is not, you know,
and just like
Revolutionary
our
Guard plants in America.
Our people there were engaged in white-collar crime, too. Journalism and you know, being a preacher, a religious person.
Right.
Sorry.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I was talking to one U.S. official over the weekend who said something I thought was notable, which was, you know, look, you may not like it, but they were convicted according to due process in their country. And this person wasn't saying this to justify it, but simply saying a process took hold of these people, and therefore you were going to have to resolve it outside of this. You know, you may not like it, but there was going to have to be some resolution.
Right, we aren't sending a SEAL team to kick down the door of an Iranian prison. This is...
Right. Yet.
Yes.
And that's next week.
And one other important thing to note...
Actually, that's what those boats were.
Oh, yeah.
Those were the SEAL teams.
Exactly.
Something tells me the
elite of the U.S. Navy were not on board those two boats. I'm just going to throw that controversial idea out there. A couple of just like weird things we should mention about this, though. There were four Americans, Sayed Abedini, Amir Hekmati, and Jason Rezaian, who were released. There was a fourth person who no one had ever heard of. Nosratullah Khosravi Rudsari. No clue who this person is. Did not get on the plane to come back to the United States. Is staying in Iran. And everyone's just kind of mum, like, I don't know who this person is. So that was a little strange. There's a man named Namazi who is also still there. He's not part of the deal, but there is that other one American who was captured or detained recently. And then Robert Levinson, of course, the former CIA contractor and FBI agent who disappeared back in 2007. The Iranians have agreed to continue working with us to try and resolve his case, which is code for where he is, and I don't think anybody really seems to know.
I don't think they've seen proof of life in 5 years.
They haven't seen proof of life in 5 years. I mean, people I have
talked... Reports that he's in Pakistan.
Right, exactly. I mean, I've talked to people in the administration about this, you know, recently, and they've said, you know, we believe the Iranians when the Iranians say we don't know where he is. So that's a heartbreaking case, too. So it did bring resolution to, you know, four people's cases. But there are some sort of weird unresolved and some pretty painful unresolved aspects, too. But overall, it seems like a pretty positive deal.
I think it's reason to celebrate.
Happy Wednesday.
Yeah. Ben, Twitter. Twitter's getting sued.
Twitter is getting sued. Pardon me in advance for getting down in some legal weeds on this one. A few months ago, one of Lawfare's student contributors, Zoe Bedell, and I wrote this article about the question of whether Apple might face a lawsuit as a result of providing encryption services to terrorists or child pornographers or other real bad guys by victims of their offenses. This was a question that Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island had posed to the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, in a congressional hearing, and she didn't know the answer. So we decided to kind of look into it, and we wrote a couple of articles about what legal theories you might use to sue Apple as a victim of terrorism. And we concluded that only one of them potentially had legs, and that was to sue them under a weird law called the Anti-Terrorism Act as potential violators of the material support law. That is, by the allegation would be that by knowingly giving encryption services to terrorists, they had violated this law and incurred civil liability in the course of doing so. This turns out to be exactly the legal theory that Twitter was sued under last week. The story has gotten a fair bit of press. A plaintiff's law firm in California has sued Twitter on behalf of the wife of a U.S. Contractor who was killed in Jordan in an ISIS attack. And the complaint alleges that Twitter has knowingly provided service to terrorists, including ISIS, despite repeated warnings from the press, the FBI, and law enforcement that these were being used in extremely dangerous ways. So on Lawfare last week, Zoe and I sort of did an analysis of this suit. We're going to do another one about some possible possible Twitter defenses. But I think this is an area that is going to be interesting to watch over the next few months and years as the plaintiff's bar confronts major tech companies over the provision of service to really, really bad guys. Short answer, the companies have some very, very strong defenses, but it is not an open and shut case, and there are circumstances that you can hypothesize. I'm not sure this suit is one of them, where particularly a company like Twitter may have some real exposure.
So I think this is incredibly interesting, especially sort of in light of the rising pressure on Silicon Valley right now. Not only do you have the Twitter lawsuit, Mark Warner says that he's looking to introduce legislation on encryption. You have sort of a high-level envoy, Loretta Lynch, Dennis McDonough, Jim Comey, James Clapper all went out last week to apparently a not super productive meeting.
Yeah, I hear it didn't go that well.
This is the word. And I think the Twitter lawsuit is really interesting to consider, sort of the notion of, as a society, we have particular ideas about what responsible behavior looks like. And those ideas are actually not determined by Tim Cook. They're determined collectively through a number of different interesting complementary mechanisms.
Well, there is that Article 8 of the Constitution that designates Tim Cook's business interests as supreme over all other articles of the Constitution.
That was in the latest Terms of Service Agreement.
Yeah.
You didn't read that?
There, and the government
the
government
on these
clicked
things
through without noticing that it had amended the Constitution by doing so.
But this is interesting because it's yet another example of the often maligned plaintiff's bar recalibrating the legal universe for us. And so it'll be interesting to see as tech companies confront not just the threat of legislation, not just the risk of being seen cozying up to Jim Comey, but now causes of action in federal court.
Right. And so, look, it bears mention that, first of all, on the specific facts of the complaint at issue, Twitter has some very strong defenses. And there's a real problem with this complaint, which is that the plaintiffs allege that Twitter provided this service. They allege that Twitter did so knowing how ISIS was using it. And they allege that ISIS, in fact, exploited Twitter in a number of important respects. What they do not allege is that there's any direct causation between Twitter's exploitation by ISIS and the specific attack, i.e. the attacker, they do not allege, was a Twitter user or had learned about ISIS on Twitter.
Isn't that kind of important to their case?
I think it's
very. I think it's called a cause of action.
Yeah.
A failure to state a cause
of
action.
Well, I think they have a real proximate causation problem in the complaint. So it may be that this specific complaint is not the one that's going to push these issues. It is also the case that Twitter has a non-trivial argument that they are immune from suit altogether, on grounds that there's a provision of law, it's 47 U.S.C. 230, which actually immunizes carriers to the extent that the offending content is provided by a third party. So in other words, if you post something on a bulletin board that's offensive or on the bulletin board itself can't be held liable for hosting that.
And this is totally what they had in mind.
Exactly.
When they wrote that provision.
And so there's an interesting question as to whether Twitter and for that matter Apple are immune altogether from this category of suit. In addition to that, there are some, I think, significant deficiencies with this specific complaint. That said, I think the plaintiff's bar is likely, as Susan says, to play a real role in this discussion that Congress is underestimating, the federal government, the executive branch is underestimating, and I think up until now, the tech companies have really underestimated.
Do you think they've underestimated or just felt that they, to your earlier point, that they were immune from this? I mean, common sense would sort of say, like, look, we put the products out there. We can't control who uses them. And how could we possibly police the universe of our consumers? If we crack down on one, we have to crack down on all.
Because that's not an argument that works for chainsaw manufacturers. This is the basic
gun
principle.
Manufacturers.
Right, but they have a more ironclad statutory carve-out. What Ben's referring to, I don't think was ever drafted with this particular consequence in mind. The question is whether now retroactively there's a way to sort of shoehorn this in.
Right. So the other really interesting question, and this is actually a subject that Zoe and I are working on a piece on now, is whether the material support law even depends on third party content to operate in this context. So imagine that, for example, that Twitter had a promotion and it gave, certain users in exchange for money, the ability to do promoted tweets, which it does, right? But now imagine that it has a promotion in which it gives you the ability to promote tweets for free. And it gave that to, say, al-Baghdadi. And imagine for a minute that he used that to tweet cat photos, which is what most people seem to use Twitter to do.
I know, I do.
I think they still would have violated the material support law, even if he didn't use the Twitter account at all.
Because they knew it was al-Baghdadi and he's a terrorist and you're giving him communications devices.
You're giving him something of value.
Right.
And the statute forbids giving something of value. It doesn't forbid giving something of value if the person then uses it to tweet things we don't like. And so I think these statutes operate somewhat differently from the statutes that companies have been held immune under. It'll be interesting to see whether...
It'll be interesting for Twitter's defense is to argue that Twitter actually has no value whatsoever.
Exactly. We did not.
We wasted their time.
Their share price might confirm this.
We...
Is it just as a general point of law?
It's the cat video defense.
Yeah. As a general point of law, and I'm not some fancy lawyer, but is
you always know when someone's about to make a profound legal point when they say, I'm not some fancy lawyer.
I'm pulling my suspenders, as you can see right here. Isn't there a difference here, though, in Twitter providing a service versus making it available? I mean, they would argue that, like, look, we didn't go out and, like, give this to al-Baghdadi. It's available, and he took it.
So I think that's a potential defense. They made a service generally available, they don't control who takes advantage of, right, of the services they make available. I think if you put that in a different context, let's say you're somebody who throws dollar bills into the street and has no control over who picks them up. It would be an interesting question if you knew when you were throwing dollar bills into the street that some of the people picking them up were ISIS, whether, and particularly if you'd been warned about that by the FBI, by the way, ISIS is picking up the dollars you're throwing into the street, is that a violation of that statute or not?
But it's further than that. And the FBI had said, by the way, there's a way to throw dollar bills such that the ISIS adherents would not pick up those dollar bills, or such that you could minimize the risks or take the dollar bill away after the fact. I mean, this really is not just... the question here is not, well, you know, little old us, we were just providing this service, how could we possibly have known? The activity at issue is the failure to remove the accounts whenever they were given all information and opportunity to do so.
Failure to remove them in such way as they were not easy to replicate.
Right.
You know, al-Baghdadi 1 gets removed, and all of a sudden al-Baghdadi 2 shows up, and then al-Baghdadi 3. It's not that Twitter's doing nothing. In fact, they cancel a lot of accounts, but the complaint alleges that they don't do enough.
And this is where I think that, you know, Twitter, this is where I think they could get hit more in the public space and politically. And I mean, and probably they have room, as does YouTube, I presume, and Facebook and Google, to make some headway and look like they're doing something, which is to say, look, we're going to create a whole new division. Now, they have to have the freedom of speech issue they keep running up against. But it seems to me that it's probably in their interest, and I would predict, they're going to do something very public to make it look like they're being much more aggressive about policing these users. Susan, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter.
So
having a big week.
He is
getting the panel out.
Doling out the punishment this week,
Ash,
over at the Pentagon.
The Punisher.
Exactly. So two reports out of the Pentagon this week. First, breaking story from our own Shane Harris.
Who?
Of the Daily Beast.
Yeah, he's not trustworthy. I wouldn't rely on that guy.
Alleging that
a great writer, but geez, I don't know the
Secretary of Defense Ash Carter is considering retroactively stripping David Petraeus of one of his stars. Petraeus is, of course, a four-star general, retired amidst a scandal while he was director of the CIA for sharing classified information with his biographer turned mistress.
And did it while he was still in uniform.
And did so while he was still in
uniform. By 3 days.
The second story is that Carter is also mulling over who and how to punish the individuals responsible for the mistaken airstrike on a Doctors Without Borders border hospital. So interesting what Bee is in Carter's bonnet this week, and how he's going to go about making the decisions about who to punish, especially, you know, obviously one is a slightly more serious context than the other. But the way that punishment ends up being precedent and the way you use it to incent future behavior and send a message to the troops. So I'm interested to hear thoughts.
Yeah.
Stars? No stars?
Well,
what say you?
You know, we talked about Petraeus' plea bargain, I think, on the podcast last year. And I think we were all of the opinion at that time that he got a sweet deal.
The fault was in his stars.
Yeah, right. This is the
as they say.
But this, you know, he pled guilty to giving 8 notebooks that he had compiled while he was the commander of forces in Afghanistan that contained code word information, notes of conversations with the president, the names of covert agents.
I believe the line in the plea deal or the information was, "This is code word classified stuff."
Right. Which he tells Paula Broadwell, his biographer, with whom he was having an extramarital affair, and then gives her the information 3 days before he retires from the army. And, you know, I think it's inarguable that he got a very light sentence, 2 years probation, $100,000 fine, for things that for people of a lower rank and lower status would have landed them in prison.
Right.
In
prison for a long time.
And the FBI wanted to charge him on a felony.
Everyone who has ever given me 8 code word classified filled notebooks while having an affair with me has gotten a lot more time than
that. Way more time. The prisons are filled with these people. Yeah. But to your point, Susan, I mean, I think that I feel like that the message that Carter is trying to convey, to the extent he's trying to convey something, but there's two problems here. One is, you can't necessarily let your senior military people get away with it just because they're famous or senior. And also, there is punishment being meted out for all kinds of related offenses to things, not necessarily classified information, but things like sexual indiscretion and misbehavior to lower level people all the time. And with the Kunduz shooting, there's a real concern, I think, being expressed now, including by some lawmakers, that this cannot just stop at the sort of kernel level and not go further up the chain and look at who else was responsible. There's even hangovers of this with Benghazi and people feeling that Petraeus and Leon Panetta should be held to greater account for what happened then. So, and to me, this is also about, sort of equal punishment throughout the ranks, regardless of what your stars are, as much as it is about holding higher level officers to a standard. It seems like that's where he's coming from.
So here's my question. 4 stars, 3 stars, how big a deal is it if you have, you're out 1 star?
I think it's worth some money.
It is worth some money.
But he's making a huge amount of money now. I mean,
sure.
That's
he
a rounding
error. He could potentially pay back hundreds of thousands of dollars.
He's got some apology jewelry to be buying, though, so he could use the extra windfall.
The best analogy I could come up with for somebody like David Petraeus losing his 4th star, it would be like going to, who was the last like really big gold medal winning gymnast or figure skater? Like the last just absolute sensation American story. I don't remember the past Olympics.
Nobody wants to admit. Ben has it on the tip
of
his
tongue. Exactly,
Michael Phelps will have it.
Sure. Yeah, Michael Phelps. They're like, yeah, exactly. And stripping him retroactively of his gold medals. It's that kind of like, this is a man who, first of all, there are only 12 generals in the army at the 4-star level at any one time. It's an extraordinary achievement.
Which is, for people who have multiplication trouble, that's 48 stars.
Right, it's 48 stars out there. It's like being a CEO of a company almost doesn't capture it. It's like being a professional athlete. I mean, the entourage, the respect, the power these people have. And David Petraeus is a man who had set his sights on getting that star early in his career. For him to lose it, it would wound and damage him, I think, on a personal level far greater than any, money he'd have to pay back, which, he's making hand over fist.
Right, and
it's the shame of it.
I also think that it's sort of, it's an interesting way to make him internalize sort of the cost of things, because, look, a lot of people said, well, the service to his country, his record, he should sort of get off on that record alone. I think this is sort of a way of telling him that the judgment he displayed here and the lack of judgment that he displayed is not fitting a 4-star general, that it can't stand, that he failed to live up to, the stars on his shoulder.
Okay, so here's my quick question before we wrap up this segment. Who else should Ash Carter punish? I mean, he's on a roll now.
He could theoretically punish Paula Broadwell. She's still a reservist. All I mean, I don't know if, what authority he has over the reserves.
I think he should go out to the Pentagon parking lot and start giving out traffic tickets.
Ooh.
And just...
Just to random
wrap it
people?
Up. Just start punishing everyone in his
Can
path.
I just, like, give him a personal enemies list?
Yeah, I think we should come up with a... If, look, if
he does have drones at his disposal.
If Rational Security listeners have ideas about who Ash Carter should punish next, please tweet them at us.
Yeah.
And make your case for
He's also available to give your children a stern talking.
Right, or you know, if there's corporal punishment issues you need taken care of, Ash is the man.
Let him deal with Bashar al-Assad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kerry, step
Spank
aside.
That man.
Carter's coming in, baby. He is pissed. Let's move on to object lessons. I'll go first. So I received in the mail yesterday, hot off the presses. It is the Korean version of my book, At War.
Congratulations.
Wow. Isn't that cool?
I wish I knew how to say that in Korean.
I do too.
It's interesting, though, the At War is still in English.
The At War is still in English, as are things like SAIC and like real-time regional gateway and like program and company.
Can you tell which of those is Shane Harris?
I'm not sure exactly which one. I think it's the first parts, but a friend of mine who speaks and reads some Korean, she's Korean-American, said that basically the first part is the Koreanization of your name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of, you know, it's basically the phonetic sounding name in Korean. So she's like, she told me basically it's like Shane Harisu, like that. Like if you were saying it in Korean, that's mm-hmm. kind of the, what the characters would kind of come out to be. It's like, what's the part at the end? You know, I hope it doesn't say like, you know, major league asshole. Shane Harris, noted fiction writer, noted fabulist. But that's pretty cool. Yeah, I opened it up last night, and can't read a damn word of it, but I'm really pleased to have that it's out there.
It'd be interesting if the text bore no relation to the text that
Wouldn't
you
it?
Wrote.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, do you know you're the translator?
Well, no. I mean, in the contracts, I mean, it spells out that they must do a faithful translation, but I haven't, like, fact-checked. I mean, for all I know, this is, like, a bootleg copy of some missing Harry Potter book. I wish it were.
I would read that book.
Well, I would cash in on this book in a way that I didn't in the actual book. Then
Harry Potter and the At War.
Yeah, it'd be like Harry Potter and the Cyber
Guard.
The cyber. What's that? Guess the cyber Cyclops. I don't know. I didn't read these books. You can tell. I have no idea. I'm just sad Alan Rickman is dead.
I am too.
Anyway.
Although not Judi Dench again.
Yes,
corrected from National Security that Judi Dench is alive.
Hasn't this woman been through enough?
Excellent.
Susan, would you like to share your object?
So my object lesson is the book Ashley's War, which I attended a Hoover book soiree for yesterday evening. Ashley's War is a pretty remarkable story about Ashley White and a group of women who served alongside special operations forces in Iraq and Afghanistan in so-called cultural support teams. They were actually sort of the precursors to the integration of services. And the stories that this book contains are just of superhuman feats and really remarkable American soldiers. It's a war story. And I was looking around at the book event last night. These events are very well attended and ordinarily are packed to the brim with every white male DC's national security community has to offer. And I was struck that there were mostly only women there. And I was struck because this is a war book. This is national security. Hmm. This is pretty remarkable stuff. And I thought it was interesting, and a little bit unfortunate to see, that men apparently are not interested in, lady soldiers, even though I'm pretty sure that those lady soldiers could,
kill most of them.
As the person who conducted the interview at this event,
to be podcast or the Lawfare podcast.
Yes, and for those particularly males who missed it, you will have a chance to redeem yourself by listening to the podcast. But I have to say, I very much agree with Susan. It was a really interesting affect how gender reversed the audience was. And part of that was that a bunch of women came for an event that I suspect they wouldn't have come for our normal events. But some of that was that a lot of men seemed uninterested in a book called Ashley's War, even when it's a book about, you know, special forces direct action. It just happens to involve the women involved in it. And I think a lot of people subconsciously didn't find that very interesting. Hmm. And I agree with Susan. It was disappointing.
Also not there last night, Shane Harris.
Well, I was actually someplace else where there were many men and women in attendance.
And Shane actually has never come to any of the Hoover Book soirees.
What are they being called?
Put him on Ash Carter's punishment list.
Yes. What? My suggestion.
Shane Harris is unacceptable social calendar.
No. I am the host here. We don't do this. Show your damn object, Ben.
So we have a sponsor again this week. Last week, you'll remember that we were sponsored by the makers of the Putin-inspired cologne. This week, Etsy, the online crafts manufacturer, is sponsoring us because it is only on Etsy that you can buy and I swear I'm not making this up, the Putin scented candle, 16-ounce soy candle that smells like Vladimir Putin for $18.50. The description reads as follows, which I'm going to try to do without laughing. Have you ever wished that there were a way to capture the scent of Vladimir Putin so you could have the...
He can't get through it.
I can't do this.
Because the answer is yes, of course.
All right, I'm gonna read the description.
All right.
Susan's gonna read this.
Have you ever wished that there was a way to capture the scent of Vladimir Putin so you could have the pleasure of smelling him whenever you wanted? The Putin-scented candle combines notes of pine, earth, and smoke billowing from the cities of your enemies. It's a manly fragrance designed to evoke the essence of Vladimir Putin and eliminate the smell of political dissidents from your home. I like it. I would want to smell that.
I would just like to have Putin in a jar.
I think if other people have Vladimir Putin-inspired products that can sponsor the Rational Security Podcast, I think that we could go a long way with this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Soy candles with a small amount of radioactive material.
Oh, I like
exactly.
That. Ben, when you fight Vladimir Putin, which we should say for the record, he's still not, has not accepted.
He still has not answered.
I even have an injured shoulder right now. And so this, you know, if the Kremlin Putin were on the ball,
chance?
This would be the chance.
We can have, like, the ring can be lined with the Vladimir Putin candle.
Yeah, we will buy Vladimir Putin scented candles for everybody who attends the fight.
Oh, I bet if we looked, we could find a collector, a non-ironic collector of Vladimir Putin
memorabilia. Oh, there have to be some in Russia, right? I mean, there have to be some. I mean, I saw a woman the other day who collects, like, plastic sushi. Certainly, like, right. Little Japanese plastic sushi things. Certainly, there's somebody collecting Putin memorabilia.
I actually, honestly, I could get into that project. You know?
I think you're going to become that collector.
I might.
I think this obsession with Vladimir Putin might give way to just, like, shelves and shelves in your house of Putin candles, Putin dolls.
I'm thinking about it.
Putin-themed musical
instruments. The image that they've selected is a particularly, for the cover of the candle, is really sort of a real display
kind
of
Soviet-style
calligraphy. Should we call it doughy masculinity? There's something kind of...
Oh, even on the cover. Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Yes.
So buy your Putin-scented candles from our sponsor, Etsy.
Etsy. Thanks, Etsy, for enriching all of our lives. Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast, thankfully. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can get links to our past shows in our archive at spaghettiontheWallProductions.com. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. Please remember, whenever you download the podcast, to leave us a review, preferably a good review, and comments as well. And keep tweeting at us. We love to hear from you. The podcast is edited by Jen Howell. The music was performed this week by Ash Carter and the Star Destroyers.
I like that.
You like that?
Good. I don't get that.
I was
going to
say Star Strippers.
Oh, Star Destroyers.
I was going to say Star Strippers, but Destroyer has more of that crushing.
Yeah.
Star Destroyers.
I like that. That's good.
You like that?
Yeah.
It was better than last week?
Yeah, last week you were down on, fell down on the job.
It was Deep Blue something, Deep Blue. Oh, God. People know nothing of your 90s pop music culture. It's lost, it's wasted on you. No, of course, our music is performed, as always, by the lovely Sophia Yan, who has no stars on her shoulders, but is a star to us.
She is a star to us.
She is a star to us.
A 4-star in our hearts.
In our hearts. Give her a 5th star, just like Eisenhower. Let's start a campaign for that. Okay. Well, we give her David Petraeus a star.
Yep. Every star that gets taken away from David Petraeus
goes to Sophia.
Gets to Sophia.
Excellent. We'll update you on the progress of that campaign next week. On behalf of my friend Susan Hennessy, thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you for having me.
And Ben Wittes, I'm Shane Harris, and we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.